Last night on 60 Minutes, they presented a segment, The Indomitable Margaret Atwood. Well, that segment had to air before we could share the interview I did with her last month at the Bardavon in Poughkeepsie, where she was honored with the Eleanor Roosevelt Lifetime Achievement Award at the Eleanor Roosevelt Banned Book Awards. The event was co-presented by Pen America and the Eleanor Roosevelt Center. Margaret Atwood's name is already shorthand for literary ambition, political imagination, and genre-bending daring. Over more than five decades, she has built a canon. Novels like The Handmaid's Tale, The Blind Assassin, Cat's Eye, and essays, poetry, short fiction, children's books, and in her latest work, she turns the lens inward. Her newest is Book of Lives, a memoir of sorts. It offers a spirited, digressive, richly detailed account of the many kinds of life she has lived, the rugged childhood in the Canadian wilderness, early academic years, cultural diasporas, Berlin of the 1980s, the circle of writers and lovers, the modern-day global pressures that shape story and freedom. In our conversation labeled A Fireside Chat with Margaret Atwood, I began by asking her if she realized just how much we all love her.
Well, not all of us.
Well, in this room, certainly.
Yes, well, that's different. Yes, never mind. It's okay, and I'm happy. And I'm happy that you all love me in this room.
I was listening to an interview that you did recently, and a journalist asked you a question, which is, in your heart, what do you think is going to happen? And you said, at my age, what heart? I ask you, physical heart, romantic heart, emotional heart, the heart of prediction. How do you feel
about
the future and the time that we live in?
Okay, the future of the United States, the future of the climate, the future of Vladimir Putin.
I didn't think this through.
I know what you want.
You know, I'm gonna say for us, for humankind.
Humankind. Well, no. How far into the future were you thinking?
Like Thursday.
We're gonna be okay on Thursday.
Okay, good. I mean, because you don't know, do you?
Nobody actually knows the future because there are many possible futures. And the future we get is going to depend partly on what we do in the present. So the choices we make now are going to have something to do with the future.
Why do you think we are so bad at that so often?
You mean so bad at making decisions in the present that then lead to effects in the future that
Correct.
We didn't anticipate.
Yes.
Well, we're human beings, and human beings do the following. They invent technologies, including speech, probably their biggest invention ever. And each of the technologies that they invent has three effects. The good effects, the bad effects, and the stupid effect you didn't anticipate. And what usually catches us up are the stupid effects we didn't anticipate. So because we didn't anticipate them, I can't tell you what they are.
But it dawns on so many of us that it is indeed stupid. I mean, that's
later,
what's so frustrating.
Later it dawns on us that it was stupid because here we are and suffering the stupid effects, but you don't think that at the time. You don't think, oh, this is going to have really bad effects. Let me give you an example. Okay, young generation, I'll pick one for you. The internet. or better still, social media. When that first came along, people were saying, isn't this wonderful? It will enable us to express our ideas to one another, and we can share things around the world, and won't that be terrific?
It sounded good on paper.
It sounded good on paper, and it did have those effects. But it also had the other effects, and it also rearranged the media landscape in a way that people were not anticipating at all, and it rearranged the political landscape. So that's just an example, or you could go back to the use of fire. You could say, well, it enabled people to cook food, and that allowed us to increase our brain power, and et cetera, and it was so good. Or you can say, well, it's often been used to burn down people's houses and, you know, fry them at the stake. I don't mean fry a steak.
Fry a steak, like fry on a steak. I guess I'm curious as to at what point in your career, besides a bad review or somebody writing a letter or that a book that you wrote was being challenged, was being concerned, was being removed, of what your initial reaction to that was.
Okay, so let's go way, way back in time. In fact, I have a letter that I wrote to the Judson School Board in Texas some time ago because The Handmaid's Tale was banned, wouldn't you know? And the students organized, and this was a town in the Texas Panhandle, you know, you wouldn't necessarily expect that. And they got the decision overturned. They said, we're grown up, we're 17, and we're certainly grown up enough to read this book. And at that time, the adults came around to agreeing with them. They got the book put back on the course. Now, I don't think this is a book that should be given to kindergarten children. Anyway, they can't read. I did not write it as a young adult novel. I wrote it as a novel for adults, but kids are a lot older now than they used to be. And anyway, when I think of what we got taught in school, some of it was pretty wild. It wasn't that there was 19th century sex right on the page, because they didn't print that, but it was often the shrubbery. And you just kind of had to deduce what was going on. Adultery, wife swapping, you know, illegitimate children. This is Thomas Hardy.
And it went with the times as the movement grew of book banning became more and more.
This is pretty recent. So the reason it comes in waves.
Right.
There was a big bunch of it around McCarthyism, but in those days it was political because the sex part was so sewn up that we didn't even let in Lady Chatterley's lover romp in the park compared to some of the stuff that's out there right now. So it was political. But then came the 60s. And then that was pretty open season for a while. Then came a reaction in the 80s, a reaction to second wave feminism largely. That's when I wrote The Handmaid's Tale. And then you had the 90s, the Berlin Wall had come down and everybody was going, oh yay, no more Cold War, we'll have world peace forever and ever and we'll go shopping a lot and dye our hair green. And that stopped in 9/11. Everything changed right there. And it stopped again with the 2008 financial crash. So these things all have an effect on people's moods. You know, how they're feeling, whether they're feeling angry, whether they're feeling happy, whether they feel that somebody has to be blamed for something. And book banning usually happens, I'll take back the usually. Book banning happens when people are feeling angry and they feel somebody has to be blamed for something. And it's also usually, and I'll take back the usually, a power grab on behalf of a certain group of people who want to demonstrate their dominance by squashing other people underfoot. So I think they should take up knitting. You know, you can get a lot of aggression
that way. Yeah, that would be much nicer.
Yeah.
What does that do to the artistic and creative spirit when these waves and these moods occur?
Well, it can have a dampening effect, but it can also, for other people, have an invigorating effect. So, because I'm very, very old, yes, before you were born, because I'm very, very old, I've lived through the Cold War, and I visited communist bloc countries and knew writers from there and knew writers who had escaped from there. So I knew there was something called samizdat, which was things people wrote but couldn't publish because the regime wouldn't let them. So they copied these things out and passed them from hand to hand, and that was samizdat. A couple of books I could mention were written piecemeal, concealed, smuggled out to the West and published there. And we all knew about that. So think of what it would take to be a writer in one of those countries under those circumstances and continue writing and also take the risk of smuggling your book out. No, this was very risky business. You could be shot, and people are in other countries now being shot for what they've written. That's why we have pen, you know?
You talk about it being...
You're supposed to go hooray. Thank you.
I mean, you talk about it being a power grab, but... which, you know, my initial reaction is, well, like, how much do you want, right?
How much power do you want?
Yeah.
Usually quite a lot, but any little bit will do. So if you can, you know, smash a librarian, goody for you, and then you feel more powerful.
And yet there seems to be no greater force and greater power than that of librarians.
Well, that's debatable.
How do you think it's debatable?
You know, atomic bomb, I'd say more powerful, but...
Oh, okay. All right, gotcha.
It is power to be a librarian, but because librarians are powerful, other people who want to be more powerful will target them. And we've seen that in Canada, too. And hooray for the librarian at the main library in Toronto who withstood a mob. Hooray for that person. And said quite simply, you know, we will not be dictated to. So it's difficult to stand up in that way, especially if you have a job, as I said. If you have a job, you can be fired. But people who really stand up are risking their jobs, as we know, and that's when they need the community to stand behind them and say, no, we do not want this person who is serving us, our community, to be fired for serving our community.
That's why there's such love for you in this room, because you're someone who has done that on such a large platform and scale, and I wonder how you feel about that, and is there a pride that comes in standing behind so many of the people in this room who are on the ground doing the work as well?
Well, that's an odd question. Canadians don't do pride. I have to explain this to you. They do. Well, maybe not so bad.
You do what?
Not so bad. You know?
Okay, not so bad.
Not too bad. But I have been, you know, canceled and attacked quite a lot. But I am of the human rights generation. I'm very old. I remember when this stuff was new and people were very enthusiastic about it. And let us just say that every other set of rights is a subset of human rights. So you cannot have women's rights without human rights. And you cannot have the rights of any other identity without human rights first. So that's why it was, you know, crucially important to people in the 50s and 60s when this was quite new. Remember how new it was. Hey, what an idea.
Right.
That everybody should have the same rights. Who ever heard of that?
And we started to set up the dominoes that more and more people would have rights. And then they get toppled.
They get what?
Toppled.
Well, I don't think you're done yet. You know, people try to topple them. But as I say, if they had totally succeeded, you wouldn't be here.
Right.
And neither would I.
But that time where we're... But that time where we're not, to me, doesn't seem that far off.
So you are being quite gloomy.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so let me say, it's always a possibility because it's never true when people say, that can't happen here. That, whatever it is, can happen anywhere given the conditions. And I did get quite a lot of that can't happen here when The Handmaid's Tale first came out. So one group of people said that can't happen here. America is the shining light of democracy during the Cold War. People in Europe just didn't believe The Handmaid's Tale. They didn't believe that America could ever go that way. Another group of people in this country said, not it can't happen here. They said, how long have we got? And that was in 1985. So yes, it's always possible. And yes, the best thing to do is to be aware of the possibilities and to try to block the attempt when it first starts happening. Because when you're halfway down the slippery slope, it's not far to the bottom.
My mother was a librarian, and I graduated from high school in 1985.
What a baby.
And
you're not old.
And she gave me a copy of A Handmaid's Tale and told me to read it. Gave it to me, asked me to read it. And I remember reading it, and I'm like, my mom gave me this? And my mother said to me, I give this to you not as a mother, but as a librarian.
Good for her.
She also said to me, after the last 5 years, the Reagan administration, I feel this is our future and you should beware.
Ooh. Well, I don't feel it is inevitably the future. I feel it is possibly the future. So as you probably know, because I've said it a lot, I didn't put anything into that book that people hadn't done already.
Right.
Sometime, somewhere. So nothing is in it is beyond the realm of human possibility. We've done it all. And I'd simply combined those elements in a place where nobody would expect them, namely Cambridge, Massachusetts, home of Harvard, belly button of the universe. I I get to say that because I went there. And I also get to say that because it was the heart of Puritan New England in the 17th century. And those folks were my ancestors, so I can say bad things about them. Whereas it would be disrespectful to say bad things about other people's ancestors. Yeah, it was there. So at the time I wrote the book, of course, Harvard was considered, you know, home of liberal, open, democratic ideas. And to some extent, it still is. But once upon a time, it wasn't. In the 17th century, it was not. I have to say, Harvard was a little peeved when that book first came out, because I had put the Secret Service in Widener Library, and all of the other buildings in the book are identifiable Cambridge landmarks. So they're a little sniffy. They didn't like the idea of these dead bodies hanging on the Harvard wall. And when we were making the first movie, they didn't let us shoot there. But they don't let people do that in general. You know, no dead bodies on the wall. It's in the Constitution of Harvard. We actually shot it at Duke. And that was interesting. We were hanging somebody. With everybody pulling on the rope, when the door to the chapel opened and out came a wedding rehearsal party. They were not amused.
And I feel that I compelled, because so many people, when they knew I was talking to you, asked me this question, which is, When the television adaptation came and furthered your story beyond Handmaid's Tale, beyond Testaments, of how you felt about that and what, if any, input there was.
Okay, I've got a title. I forget what it is. It doesn't mean I have any actual power, but you can see it on the screen.
Yeah.
It's executive something. So what that means is that I get to read the scripts, I get to make futile notes on them, but sometimes I really strongly object to something, and I talk to the showrunner, whose name is Bruce Miller, and he's got that job because he read that book as a teenager in high school and vowed that when he grew up, that's what he was going to do. And I think that happens with a lot of things that people do later in life when they have the power and ability. It's something that's inspired them as young people in high school. And that's why high school libraries are so important. So I have said to Bruce, "Bruce, you can't kill that baby." And he says, "Oh, I wasn't going to." I said, "Well, just don't. And by the way, you cannot kill Aunt Lydia." And he says, "Oh, no, I wasn't going to do that either." I said, "Well, you stuck a knife in her and shoved her over the banister." He said, "She's in hospital. She's getting better."
But generally, you were pleased.
Generally, the team is extremely dedicated, and I've had some pretty unmentionable things made of some of my work, but this is not one of them. This is really dedicated, and they have followed the same rule. They don't put anything into the scripts that they cannot show a real-life reference for. So they've got researchers who comb through, you know, history and say, "Oh yes, this is where they had mass drownings."
As we wrap up, I have to ask you about, you have a memoir coming out, and you say it's a memoir of sorts.
Well, it's not very solemn all the time.
Why does it have to be?
Exactly. So in my mind, a memoir is what you remember. And what you mostly remember, looking back over your long, long decades on this planet, is stupid things you did, catastrophes that occurred, stuff like that.
But that's not solemn. Those are things that you look back and laugh at.
Not always the catastrophes, but they are memorable. The stupid things you did aren't funny at the time. And nor are, say, your romantic entanglements when you were 17. You know, deeply wounded heart. But when you're 30, you think that's funny. And when you're 65, you can't remember that person's name. Just to give you a bit of hope out there, right?
But did you find it to be a rather joyful process?
Yes, mostly it was. Mostly it was a lot of fun. And sometimes it wasn't.
And did you know those times were coming, that it wasn't going to be, that there were aspects of your life that you had to cover?
Into every life a little rain must fall.
Right.
Yes, it must, because it always does. But did I know when I was writing it? Or did I know when I was about to live it?
Well, I was asking about the writing. I mean,
okay, but stick to that. yeah, of course, because I know the plot, right?
Right.
If you write a memoir when you're 25, you actually don't know how it's going to end. But I kind of do.
And it's pretty good.
The ending?
I'm not pushing anything, but asking is that...
Up to now.
Yes.
Yeah, up to now. Well, you know, read it and see. You'll get to the sad parts.
Well, I did read it, and I there certainly are sad parts, but...
Did they give you the one with the pictures?
I'm sorry?
Did yours have pictures in it?
No.
No, well, you need the finished one. It's got the pictures.
All right. What the hell is in it, Margaret? I hope, it seems like you do, I hope that you realize of how much love there is for you, not only in this room, but in this world. How important... How important you are to so many of us as a guide and as someone, and you keep saying you're old, but you're helping us understand where we're all headed.
What do you mean, Joe?
Read the poem.
Oh,
read the poem.
Woo, look at you. I have to read both of them.
Okay.
At once. This is going to be a challenge for you. You're right-handed?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you have a fairly strong personality, as I guess you're aware. and you have a very weird thing on your line of the intellect. It divides. Okay, like that. I've never seen that before. And you're not averse to combat, let us say. Yes, you do not shy away from it. You will never be a murderous dictator. Sorry. Sorry about that. But you're reasonably directive, shall we say. And over here, I have to, yes. Okay. Yeah, there's that weird stuff that happened in your childhood.
My mother gave me your book when
I
was
17. Yeah, I think that'll do it. Yeah, it's right there. Yes. Okay, we could go into this in some detail on another date.
Well, I'm curious, what's the division of the intellect? What does that mean?
Well, since I've never seen it before, I can't tell you.
Okay.
You're gonna have to look it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually never seen it at all. Woo, you're weird. Yeah, so part of it is just the reason. It's a straight across reason line. And then the other part goes down into the intuition realm. So the system I'm using is the old Renaissance one in which the hand is divided like that into sections and each of the fingers is named after a planet, because that's how they thought in those days. It was all connected with astrology. So that's Jupiter, Saturn, Apollo, and Mercury, and Venus and the moon right there, and that's the field of Mars. So I'm not going woo, 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 I'm getting your aura. I'm just looking at the lines in the classic way that they used to do when everybody thought this was real.
Ladies and gentlemen, Margaret Atwood. Speaking with Margaret Atwood on October 11th at the Eleanor Roosevelt Band Book Awards, where she received the Eleanor Roosevelt Lifetime Achievement Award for Bravery in Literature. The event was co-presented by PEN America and the Eleanor Roosevelt Center. Again, the name of the new book is Book of Lives, a memoir of sorts by Margaret Atwood. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.